Welcome to Burning Platforms, a podcast about the intersection of politics and technology brought to you by Per Capita's Centre of the Public Square. I'm Peter Lewis. This week we meet Vanessa Paik, co-founder of Australian Community Managers, to discuss the role of human moderation in an age of automation. But first, our regular wrap of news from around the world of politics and tech with our panel, Health Engine CEO Dan Stinton and Digital Rights Watch Chair Lizzie O'Shea. All right, well, joining us in our virtual town hall this evening, my regular panelists, who I normally just jump over and go, yeah, there's Dan, yes, Lizzie, let's properly introduce each of you. Dan Stinton, CEO of Health Engine. Hello, welcome to Burning Platforms. How are you, Dan? You see, I'm being a better host.
Thanks, Peter. This is a strange development, but a welcome one. I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And Lizzie O'Shea, Chair of Digital Rights Watch, apart from doing some quick Googling for the next question, how are you?
I'm good. I'm very fast at Googling, and it's always a joy to be chatting to you and Googling at the same time.
It seems to happen at the same time way too often. And Vanessa Pace, who is our special guest, one of the world's leading specialists in community management, and we've invited her in to help moderate our conversation this evening, and we'll be deep into what is a really important part of the online infrastructure that most people don't spend a moment thinking about in the deep dive in the second half hour. But let's get into some of the big news globally around tech and platforms that have come across our desk. And a special thanks always to Amy Denmead, who is our human aggregator of all the most interesting things on the web. I'm going to kick off with the question, was Google's incognito always just a ruse? Sometimes Google seems like it's the grown-up digital platform until you look under the bonnet. And I normally, when I'm not using DuckDuckGo, which is my default, but then when you realize that nothing's coming up in the search, you move to Google, you switch it to incognito, and you get that little avatar that looks like an undercover agent. And I always thought that was about keeping secrets for yourself, but in fact, the avatar is also spying on you. And this week, on April Fool's Day, no less, Google has agreed to destroy billions of browsing records after a long lawsuit in the States, in California, where else? Under the settlement, Google will update its disclosures about what it collects in private browsing. It will also let incognito users block third-party cookies for 5 years. So there's no settlement as such. I think there was a seek force for damages as high as $7 billion. I think there's still an opening to sue for individual damages. But it seems like an interesting case in that I suspect that all the fine print people have clicked onto when they've signed up, and it's just more that Google has been putting forward something that is offering privacy that wasn't actually anything of the sort. So let's bring in our resident class action lawyer. What do we know about this case, and why do you reckon Google settled before a final judgment, Lizzie?
This is a really interesting case, in my opinion, because in part what you're talking about is interesting. It's a promise of privacy. But in fact, when you put on incognito mode, there's an argument that what you end up doing in incognito mode is in fact more revealing of your personal habits than what you might do not in incognito mode. So you've got some weird fungus on your toe. Or
like it's inducement to go down the dark corridors of your soul.
Yeah, or you're
putting on the dark glasses and the hat.
That's right, exactly. You're no longer yourself, so you can be more liberated in your desires as expressed through a search, a search query. I don't know what that looks like, but I think that's an interesting point because it means that this information is incredibly valuable, and the argument in this class action was that it's worth upwards of $5 billion or similar. And so, you know, the Californian data protection regime is very good in relative terms. It's better than Australia, for example.
So that's why the case there, right?
Exactly. You have an entitlement to certain kinds of things, including the right to ask for data to be deleted, which they've agreed to do, for example. And, you know, of course, Google claims that this was all just technical data and it was just, it was kept so that they could assist with allowing people to use their website or their browser without the difficulty and remembering certain things about users to ease the process of using Chrome. But that doesn't really wash when the whole purpose of going incognito is to be more private. So, you know, that's Google's claim. They said that they'll delete that information. The other thing, of course, about the California regime that we don't have in Australia, for example, is the entitlement to penalties. And I think this is like a classic case, to be honest, where penalties would be appropriate. And in California, there's an amount, like an upwards amount of towards $750 per person, I think it is. But, you know, more if the damage can be substantiated as being greater. And the effect of that is, you know, mass claims like this, where it's not really easy to identify the harm that might arise, especially not if you have to put it in dollar terms. But clearly there's a...
Or if you have to go to court and say, this is the bit of my web browsing that's really going to embarrass me that they've
yes,
taken.
Yes, like, here's me trying to have an Bruce affair. Bruce Layman incognito. I know, it's a very unappealing thing to litigate, not to mention it's difficult to articulate the harm. And so there's a real utility, I think, in having a standardised approach to harm that both allows plaintiffs to get some kind of remedy, even if it's not quite a complete one, but also to act as a deterrent against this kind of behaviour, because that's the other flip side of not being able to articulate damage, is that companies then get away with it. So I am, you know, the settlement terms appear to be confidential, but I am kind of curious to know what happened with that provision. But I think it's quite a clear case of why in Australia we need something similar. We need the availability of penalties as well as damages to serve that deterrent motivation and of privacy regulation, and to give people remedies so that they don't have to go to the effort of proving it, even if it's in circumstances that aren't quite as, I don't know, salubrious. What's the correct term here? Am I using that word wrong?
Auspicious? Maybe
I mean
I don't know.
Racy?
I know
it. Racy?
Salacious. Vociferous. Dan, is this so? What you're one person that's been arguing in Australia for a fair and reasonable test around data. Is it a totally different conversation if we're not talking about whether or not the consent's been specifically given and whether the use is just fair and reasonable?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but I think this is totally relevant, because from a consumer's point of view, if you go into incognito mode, I think you would expect that Google is not collecting any data on you at all. And the reality is obviously quite different, or has been quite different up until now. I guess we'll see what happens going forward. And therefore, would a consumer think it's fair and reasonable for Google to be collecting that data in that mode? And the problem that we have is that Even whether it's in incognito mode or not, we don't really have a good idea of what Google does with all the data that it collects on consumers and how that appends it to individual user profiles and how they use that for the purposes of selling targeted advertising or anything else that they might want to market or do. And so, yeah, I mean, I would hope that when the privacy reform finally comes through in Australia, given it is likely to be built on a fair and reasonableness test, that this kind of thing would also be completely outlawed. And if you go into incognito mode, a reasonable person would expect that you're not being tracked in any way, shape, or form, and that's not the case.
How important is trust when you're running a platform, Vanessa, and how damaging is this to Google?
I mean, I think, you know, if this were 20 years ago, a kinder, gentler, more innocent world, it would be extremely damaging. And quite rightly, I think all the things that Lizzie and Dan were talking to. I mean, it should be damaging, you would think, but I my feeling is that, you know, sort of looking at the state of the discourse is, you know, the mistrust is pretty endemic, be it sometimes more informed mistrust and sometimes just that general suspicion that bad things are happening and everything's out to get us. So I think, look, it matters. I think it, to me, interestingly, I think you're really right, Lizzie, about that idea of the representation of this idea of, you know, I am incognito, therefore that is going to have an impact on my behavior in, you know, highly individualized ways. And then what that translates to from a user's perspective. So thinking even about things like, you know, generative AI and this idea of AI watermarking and sort of marking content as artificial or synthetic or not, this idea of representation, right? And how trustworthy is it or isn't it? And so this, I feel this is just like another kind of, you know, death of a thousand paper cuts of trust, if you like. So it's not good. I don't think people are terribly surprised. Probably pretty worried given the, you know, the interesting effect that has in terms of our identity and the way we use these tools.
Pete, I'm not sure if trust is going to be impacted though when Google's market share is 92% from a search engine point of view, and from Chrome's point of view, I think it's north of 60% globally. So
if you lose trust in God, it's still God, right?
But
it's who's the audience of that trust? That's my question. So maybe that's true for consumers who still rely on Google, in part because Google has a policy of, kind of crowding out competitors. But if you have to convince a regulator that you're trustworthy, it's a different matter. If you have to convince a body that approves a merger or an acquisition, this is the kind of evidence that I think would suggest you're not a trustworthy company. So I understand why consumer-facing representations or a reputation is not necessarily the touchstone now for these companies in a world in which there are very proactive regulators in Europe as well as, you know, increasingly the United States.
Speaking of trust, our favorite AI company, the one that sacked the board that had been appointed to ensure it would put the collective good ahead of profits, OpenAI, has a new product on the market. And Dan, it wants us to deal with the downside of its great new invention. Do you want to take us through what I think they're calling, not health engine, that's your one, but voice engine?
Yes, two very different things. I think it's important to say from the outset. So OpenAI released, the latest iteration or the latest product, if you like, off their large language model technology, and it was called Voice Engine. And look, it's remarkable tech. I think that's the first thing to say about it. It can basically, from 15 seconds worth of recorded audio of someone's voice, it can basically create. You can use that to generate any voice you anything you want from that particular individual's voice saying whatever the hell you want. Hopefully, I've explained that probably poorly, but hopefully you get what I mean. So OpenAI released this end of last month. There's a whole bunch of demos on their website which are quite remarkable because it enables you to do that basically and feed in sort of 15 seconds worth of voice of someone in, and effectively you've got a completely new character which you can get them to say whatever you want. Now, interestingly, they are taking what I think is the prudent approach, and they're not actually releasing this product out into the wild because particularly in an election year, a massive election year around the world, but especially in the United States, thankfully, they are recognizing the risk of this, which is, you know, clearly it would be pretty easy for people to create deep fakes of Biden or Trump or anyone else in the race and use that to manipulate voters. But I mean, I would make the point, OpenAI are just one company. And what I think is becoming really apparent is that, yes, it looks like there's going to be two or three dominant AI companies around the world, OpenAI being one, Google being another, Microsoft being another, whether that's with OpenAI or not.
Gee, they sound like the platforms that have spent the last couple of decades harvesting all our personal information.
Yes, true. Although there is, I don't know if this is a good or bad thing in this case, there's also a stack of smaller models which are doing a pretty damn good job of keeping pace. And I'm not an expert on the technology, but you know, it does seem that because the nature of machine learning is that, you know, one machine can learn everything that another machine has learned so quickly in very simple terms that I'm sure people working in this space would laugh at. But nonetheless, there does seem to be a whole bunch of smaller company with large language models that are not that far behind them. And so the expectation, I think, is that we're going to actually have less responsible companies. I'm not sure if you call OpenAI responsible, but nonetheless, less responsible companies that will be releasing this technology into the world, including in this year. And so I think in that circumstance, we're probably going to still be flooded with a whole bunch of deepfakes that potentially could influence the US election and other elections around the world. Now, the interesting thing about this, though, or the perhaps the slightly depressing thing about this, is that OpenAI have effectively outsourced the problem in a way by finishing
to everyone else
to everyone else with the blog post when they publish this. And they have said, and I'm quoting here, specifically, we encourage steps like phasing out voice-based authentication, I should say, as a security measure, exploring policies to protect the use of individual voices in AI, educating the public in understanding the capabilities and limitations of AI technologies, and accelerating the development and adoption of techniques for tracking the origin of an audio-visual content. So, look, we've created the problem, folks, but it's up to you to go and fix it. And we're going to wash our hands of that, because that might impact on our profits. I mean, it's call me cynical, but it's fairly typical behavior from these Silicon Valley companies.
I know you're off the clock, but this looks like another class action waiting to happen, doesn't it, Lizzie? Come
on. This is just our potential cases meeting, isn't it? Can someone explain to me what the use case is for this apart from deep fakes? Like, I mean, so, I can't understand.
For non-verbal people.
Something, democratization, something. Sorry, I'm being cynical.
I know. Don't be so cynical, Vanessa. We're not a cynical show.
Well, I think
OpenAI is doing this for, to assist people who have serious disabilities. I mean, it strikes me as that. I don't think it's hard to be cynical about that, because
the other thing is, you don't need someone else's voice. If you're you would create your own voice. So they had the three: reading to your kids, or like reading to someone, or if you can't read, translating, and for non-verbal people. But it seems like a limited amount of benefit for such a large bit of risk, doesn't it? Like, what is the good news?
Yeah. I mean, I also understand why people who are non-verbal may want to have their own voice, or they're losing their voice. Like, there's a beautiful piece in The Guardian, actually, about a woman who donates her voice, you know, in a project. And it's, you know, like, because somebody's had to have their voice box removed, and they talk about that. And I understand that, but that's not why OpenAI is doing this, right? Like, it strikes me as a very odd thing to do, other than for the purposes of creating deep fakes, which is obviously, you know, pretty alarming business model. But I remain a bit confused about that. But I do sort of wonder whether voice is like a form of biometric data that we don't usually think of in those terms, and whether it needs to be kind of regulated in that way, because it is something that can't really be, you know, you can't redo your voice like you redo your password if it got hacked or whatever. And so it sort of escalates the protections that are needed in a way that I don't think people think of your voice as a form of biometric data. It also strikes me that, you know, we had Michael on last week talking about neurotech, and that in fact authentication may end up being, I think, then through brainwaves now rather than
You have drunk that Kool-Aid, haven't you?
I haven't. I've just been reading about it, and I realized, God, and this is just an excuse to take more biometric information, because verification becomes harder and harder. And, you know, none of the companies that you deal with, whether it's like a, you know, real estate agent, a bank, the government, you know, none of these places have offices that you can go in and present yourself to in the way that they used to. Now you have to all do this stuff online. So it requires further and further invasion into your literal physical being to get your neurotech to verify yourself. It does seem like this constant drive to solve problems that could be solved in other ways.
It's super forensic too. Yeah. I share Lizzie's kind of, let's say in an effort not to be too cynical, curiosity about why this. I think, you know, I agree there. It's probably some really beautiful use cases out there in terms of, you know, creating a lot of really empowering assistive technology for certain folks and certain communities potentially. But it seems, I'll be honest, it seems like they're sort of, they're developing a weapon.
Yeah.
It is alarming, you know, and that twist in the tail, as you pointed out, Pete and Dan, around, the performative neutrality of, we just made the thing, you know, off you go. You guys can figure out this. We're not the experts in that.
We're just the science. We're not the society. Before we move on, do you want to give us the case of the deodorant AI spokes model, just because you got excited about it? Does it fit in, Dan?
Well, I think it's sort of, it's
tangentially,
it's a continuation of the same problem, because there are also commercial considerations of this technology. Sorry to be the boring commercial guy again, but you know, there was a really interesting story in New York Magazine published at about the same time that this tech was, or this blog post was published by OpenAI. And it told the story of a 24-year-old content creator who lives in New Jersey, who she creates digital marketing videos for brands. And she was contacted by an agency in France that gave her a whole bunch of a job to do of reading a whole bunch of things and taking videos of herself. And then they then use that to then create other marketing videos for other products which were completely unrelated to what she was originally contracted to do. And they used AI to do that. So I guess it was a deepfake in a way, but it was a deepfake where they paid for this individual's voice and video and created completely new voice and video purposes for the purpose of selling commercial products that she had nothing to do with. And by the way, the way she found out about this was because she saw it on the internet when her friends were aghast at seeing her online. This is how she found out about it. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, there's probably no law against this at the moment. You can probably do it. So I think it's not just the deepfake kind of political or misinformation ramifications. It's also the commercial ramifications for so many people which rely on this as their stock and trade.
That's just Joan is awful, isn't it? Was that the Black Mirror?
Yeah. Sorry, Dan, I was just saying maybe she needs to join the Screen Actors Guild.
No kidding.
I mean, yeah, we literally just had a whole, you know, a US summer's worth of conversations about that exact dilemma.
But those influences are the Wild West. Jordan's done some papers on this, and it's kind of like a whole industry that's just been made up with no guidelines or anything, with no protections for both the people working in it, but also none of the constraints on pushing products that they would have it anyway. So yeah.
Anyway, it's a very utilitarian kind of canary in the coal mine, because it'll, you know, if it's happening there, it's going to happen everywhere. I think you're right, Dan.
Yeah. Look, let's move, Lizzie, and less levity on this issue, which is the question: are we witnessing AI's first genocide? I know you've been very closely following not just the tragedy unfolding in Gaza, but also the way technology's been deployed. Your friend Anthony Lowenstein's award-winning book, The Palestinian Laboratory, brought a lot of this to light. So do you want to take us through what you've been thinking about as this has been unfolding?
Yeah, well, so close followers of this issue, which I think is probably many people actually, will have seen a recent story in 972 Mag, and it was in collaboration with some other media organisations as well, about some of the AI tools that are being used in this war on Gaza by the Israeli army. And in particular, there's one called Lavender, which is essentially a way of using artificial intelligence to generate targets based on information inputs. And, you know, that sounds kind of quite neutral, I suppose, but the consequences have been really, really grave in Gaza. So the idea is of this system, according to reports, that information is put into it that gives rise to targets based on people's seniority or perceived seniority in Hamas. And the kind of data that it appears to be going in includes things like cell phone information, but also social media connections, phone contacts and photos. So, you know, information that consumer information that would in, you know, that is collected routinely by large numbers of companies in places like Australia as well, is being used as a surveillance tool in places like Gaza to then create a kill list, essentially. And that's pretty alarming because of the way in which that can be wrong. But then, of course, that's obvious to many people who, you know, follow algorithmic decision making. The reality is that the kind of inputs that are being used by the Israeli army are very alarming, like the sense of proportionality, which is a requirement in the rules of war in international humanitarian law, to say that when you take, you know, you engage in violence, that it has to be proportionate, and that you have to do what you can to minimize civilian casualties. The inputs that the Israeli army are using appear to be completely different to any other conflict in human history. So large numbers of civilians that are likely to be killed at the same time as a target. are being tolerated. So, you know, whole families being wiped out because somebody may be associated with the target. So the parameters of how this technology is being used is really alarming. And it's arguably nowhere near what would be required in international humanitarian law. And I expect in years to come, we're going to look at this as a very serious departure from norms that are usually practiced in the theater of war. And I mean, I say usually in the last, you know, post-World War II period, you know, the last 70 odd years or so, where there's been a bit more coherence or an understanding that there are red lines around certain kinds of ways around which you would conduct a conflict, and that violence is only used in limited circumstances. Civilians are protected, civilian infrastructure is protected, and also that attacks are proportionate. And all these things appear to be going out the window under the justification of using artificial intelligence to generate targets in ways that are much better than human intelligence. And the reality is that that's resulted in huge numbers of women and children killed, often when a target might not even be home. So targeting homes rather than other places during the conflict. But also, you know, I think it sort of does go to explaining why we've seen such a high rate of death of journalists and humanitarian aid workers. You know, north of 200 aid workers, not just the seven, including one Australian from the World Central Kitchen. And this starts to make a bit more sense when you understand that this might be the system that they're using to create targets, because people who are working in humanitarian aid end up moving around to sites of conflict, to sites of violence to assist with that. Journalists do the same thing. So these people end up on looking at their data points a lot like a target. And it's so easy to get on that kill list, it seems, from the reporting, that you can understand how they may be becoming targets themselves, and the tolerance for error has been very high among the Israeli forces. So, you know, this is not new, I should say. This kind of programs have been reported in the past, and there's one that was called Skynet, which I think if it's from Terminator, I don't know. I've never actually seen Terminator, dare I say it, but in the US, that was used in Pakistan. It was leaked by Edward Snowden, and there's a really famous example of this program from Snowden documents where they were using it, this kind of data, same thing, to work out who might be tribal leaders in Pakistan, and that was for the purposes of conducting drone attacks. And then one of the people that appeared on the list was an Al Jazeera journalist, and he was pointing out how terrible this was. You know, he found out about this and wrote an op-ed in Al Jazeera, and that was in 2017, so quite a long time ago. This appears to just be escalating and being used as a justification to engage in greater lethality when it comes to the use of force, and obviously huge amounts of error and large numbers of civilian casualties, including aid workers and journalists and the like, which I would suggest in retrospect, we're going to perceive this as being deeply problematic in violation of international humanitarian law. And I do think it's time that we kind of come to terms with the fact that these tech products might seem neutral or seem, you know, in other settings, the use of this kind of data and data profiling seem innocuous, but in fact, it's being used to kill people at a mass scale. It's pretty troubling.
If these systems are running off information, like, what role could Australia be playing in this
I do think that's a very interesting question. So we do obviously have a intelligence base in Pine Gap that is geographically significant because of the way the world turns and the like. We can gather data from places like the Middle East with ease, given the location of Pine Gap. And that base is organised with full knowledge and concurrence of the Australian government, but it's a US base and it's been there for a long time. We know that the US shares information with Israel, and it's been reported as well that they shared things like locations of hospitals so that they wouldn't be attacked, or sites of aid delivery and the like, which still many of these sites ended up still being attacked. And so you do wonder whether we've got obligations generally as a signatory to the Genocide Convention to do what we can to prevent a genocide occurring. And I do wonder whether at some point that intelligence sharing regime will come into that, into question in that context, because it's not just about delivery of arms. It's clearly now that warfare is conducted using intelligence for these kinds of purposes, and this is a form of weaponry of sorts, and that if we're contributing to that, I think it's very dangerous, and it comes close to, or, you know, there's an argument that's in violation of our obligations under the Genocide Convention.
Anyone else want to weigh in?
I'm not sure I've got much to add, Peter, other than to say this looks like the most lethal end of a trend which has been happening and sort of ratcheting up, where we're outsourcing decisions to machines and using data as the reason. I mean, we saw an already very harmful version of this with RoboDebt in Australia, and this just feels like that on steroids, with consequences which are just horrific. The ability for anyone to be making, effectively outsourcing literally life and death decisions to AI bots of a kind, and using data in this way to be able to inform decisions, is just, it's a deeply troubling development. But I'm not sure what the remedy is.
Mm-hmm. On that note, maybe it's time for us to talk about moderation. Now, Vanessa Paik, who's our special guest, is one of the doyens globally in community management. She sent through her CV, and she's worked across a bunch of businesses that have been serious about building community: Lonely Planet, realestate.com.au, Envato, Australia Post, where she's consulted on all things community, from startups to government. She co-founded the Australian Community Managers, which is a centre of excellence for online community management and training. And she's about to host the All Things in Moderation virtual conference, which is like the biggest thing in moderators' diaries globally, with technologists, regulators and researchers, and maybe some of us as well. So welcome. Let's start on that theme of moderation. So much of what makes the internet work is anathema to moderation. It's excess and noise and division. So why did you choose to moderate?
So, and thank you for the lovely intro. I will absolutely take the word doyen. So I think this is really interesting. So look, I'll not to add to the resume, but I want to say this for a reason. So I've been doing this stuff for a long time. So I've been kind of in and about communities of varying kinds, moderating them, community managing them, and those are different things. We'll maybe talk a little bit about that. But and as a user in these spaces, you know, since the late 80s, early 90s, so not their full life, but a good long amount of it. So I've got a bit of a longitudinal view of this stuff. And, you know, and then as I've gone into scholarship around this and research as well, in particular looking kind of the history of these spaces and the kind of the cultural history of online community management, yeah, we've always moderated these spaces. That's not really news to any of you, I know. But I think we do, you're right. We particularly when we think about internet histories and the way we landed where we've landed, you know, so much of it is about these liberating structures and kind of, you know, the sort of neoliberal politics and the California ideology and all these sort of things, these impulses that are about less regulation, not more, throwing off the handrails, democratizing impulses, etc. You know, and I would say those are not counter to moderation, although they might feel like they are. But all these spaces have always been, let's say, mediated. You know, whether you've got your kind of early sysop BBS folk who are, you know, what started out often as a technologist and suddenly like accidentally burst a community on their bedroom server. And we're like, oh, there's people and I've got to like come up with social norms and figure out like this place kind of has a culture and what do I want to do with it? Do I want to be very hands off and ignore it? Or, you know, and then they're designing governance without ever thinking of themselves as, you know, as a governance person or a sort of a culturalist in that way. But moderation, that kind of that social and relational labor is what powers the internet. And what we've sort of seen happen, I suppose, is a really interesting journey with that through several waves of platformization, sort of a bit of a decoupling, I would argue, of what was originally a very sort of social and cultural first practice that sat really closely bound up with the technology, through sort of AOL, CompuServe, these sort of early giant platforms coming in, and recognizing the currency of that, recognizing, I think, early on how that could fuel some of the infrastructures and the business models that we've already touched on in this conversation and you all talk about a lot, and saying, oh, well, we better sort of divest these folk of that agency. We can use them over here. We're going to let them do this stuff free. We're going to give you free internet. It costs a fortune in that era. That's great. You can do that. And sort of the through line through history to, Reddit IPOing a couple of weeks ago, arguably on the back of its work of, tens of thousands of moderators building up the social currency of that platform asset, if you like. So it's a really interesting, complex thing. I think it's kind of misunderstood. People think of it, confuse it with censorship, I think, a lot of the time. Obviously, excessive moderation can amount to censorship, and that's not something you want to entertain. But I think this moderation as this social and cultural practice, not just regulatory, as a the work of community management, of social norming, of sort of modulating voices, of figuring out who's loudest, should they be, what voices aren't being heard, the sense making that goes on with kind of building those online cultures, whether it's happening in a really small scale or at kind of that giant platform ecosystem scale. It's really interesting stuff. That's why I've been attracted to it. I came into it as a user.
Have you noticed a change over the last few decades? Like, has the surveillance model of, surveillance capitalism changed the way moderation works because it rewards the excessiveness? Has it made it harder, or has it changed the way that communities are managed?
Yeah, look, it definitely has. I think there's the factor you just mentioned. So if you are creating or kind of convening your people on one of the big platforms, obviously. And so we obviously, let's remember, we came from a bit more diverse sort of community ecosystem, platform ecosystem, different social media sites, different bespoke tools for building community. And now, they're a lot more centralized, a lot more concentrated. And if you are operating in those environments, which nearly all people are, then yeah, you are subject to the whim of that. So a couple of interesting things, you're contending with the cultural outputs of the algorithm, which may steer it in a certain direction, as you said, you might. And because you're kind of caught in the thoroughfare, it's very hard to kind of guardrail yourself off in some of these platforms. Even if, let's say, you're on Meta, on Facebook, and you're putting up a private group, so you're not just in the, complete town square, but it's still hard, right? You're still ultimately in the same place, subject to a lot of the same machine interventions and business models and logics, algorithmic logics that the whole thing is. The other thing I would say is just the algorithmic literacy, I reckon, of a lot of these sort of community managers, even volunteers who are not doing this professionally. Now, community management's a pretty well-established profession. It's actually quite highly paid, especially here in Australia. But, you've got folks who are weighing up needs of my users, my group, my people, whatever that purpose or context is, versus gaming the algorithm. And that's very contextual, right? So if they're running a commercial community on behalf of a business, they're trying to represent their users, they're trying to be their advocate and do right by them and what they're trying to build, but they're also employed by a business. And so they're serving those business goals, commercial goals. So in order to do that, they're going to have to kind of game for engagement and kind of understand the algorithm and understand all these systems, right? That surveillance system, and plug into it in an optimizing way for that business. But if they're in there, as a small peer support group, different situation, but same logics typically apply. And that's one of those interesting things. Lizzie, I've heard you talk before about, the flattening of culture. And I think, there's a lot of context flattening that I've seen over these decades with community, particularly in these platforms, particularly with these tool sets, which, are a little bit ad hoc here and there, a little bit configurable here and there, but broadly, everything is square peg, and if your community is something a little bit different, that can be incredibly challenging and create all sorts of really challenging social fissures that then you as moderator, community manager, admin, whatever your role is, you have to unpack.
I find this so interesting because your intro, Pete, was to say that you thought that moderation and regulation of content is like the antithesis of all that makes the internet good. But I sort of see it in the opposite way. Like, I feel like moderation is what makes the internet a nice place to be.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean that. That must have sounded horrible. But no, assume that I was saying moderation was exactly what
we love you, Lizzie.
Right,
you can say.
Yeah, you go.
No, but I know what you're getting at, because of course, you know, it's that, you know, kind of Grateful Dead California ideology idea that the internet kind of exists beyond regulation, and that's what makes it wonderful. And that's, there's a grain of truth in that, don't get me wrong. But I also think so much of moderation occurs kind of beyond sight. Like it's like editing, like, you know, when it's good, you sort of don't notice. But that makes it hard to for editors to get, I think, their due. But I, can I ask though, before you go too much longer, you was talking about who might be a content moderator or a community manager and how you define that. And it, you know, when I think of it, I often think of volunteers, like, and Reddit's a whole thing I'd be interested to hear your views on, but is one example where there's a lot of volunteer content moderators or lots of other groups that you might be on social media and be part of, and people spend their time, I think, in quite an difficult task of managing those communities, often for free. But obviously there's the commercial side to it. Do you mind just giving us some context of what this field is with some definitions or what you understand it to look like, as in who works in it, what kind of jobs they have, and, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for the question. And it's a really good one, right? Because, you know, again, moderation doesn't come up, you know, in the headlines terribly much, perhaps for the best. And when it does, it tends to be, you know, one of a few things. It's often, you know, moderation conflated with censorship, as I said, and perhaps some political sort of discourse, or it's the horrific conditions of commercial content moderators who are working outsourced for, you know, one of the major platforms. But there's a whole spectrum in between. You know, I think of it as a bit like a family tree, right? And you're right. So volunteers are a huge part of that. And obviously there's a lot of shades of volunteer too. There's folks that are really stepping up to kind of own a space and really kind of sort of take control of the cultural agency over that space in an ecosystem like Reddit. But then there's also, you know, the neighborhood Facebook, you know, admin, and there's folks, there's a lot of accidental community managers, tons and tons of them, who are like, I didn't really ask for this, but here I am ending up moderating this space. But in that spectrum, you've got, you know, you've got teachers who are kind of moderating learning communities. And again, they're like, this is not exactly my thing, but now I'm thinking about content and community guidelines and social norms and how to translate that there, and how do I make that culture appear in this space, you know, our educational institution culture, workplaces, especially through COVID, when everyone shifted remote, suddenly you had CEOs and team leaders being like, can you make a workplace culture happen online? And, you know, community managers, I know everyone, like, well, of course you can, but it's a whole thing. And you've got
social media managers. Don't go to meetings in your underpants. That was the first one, wasn't it?
Social media managers. Now, they're an interesting one because that's a very popular job title. Plenty of people do that job here in Australia, for example. Some of them are managing communities, right? And it's sort of a bit of a twain for me. And often that's a commercial role, but not always. They are, you know, managing a space on a social media platform or multiple. Sometimes that job description, part of it is build relationships, build trust, build a sense of community, deepen belonging, maybe in relation to our brand, maybe not, maybe just for the sake of it, maybe it's a causal or activist community. So there's those kind of communal elements, but then some social media managers are really more in the audience business, and it's more, you know, closer along the spectrum to social media marketing, social media advertising, where their remit is create engaging content, you know, work the algorithm, get people to do stuff that's in our favor, obviously keep the peace, don't let things get illegal or out of control, so there's that moderation bit, but it's less about let's build relationships, right? That's not what it's about. So community management, as distinguished from sort of social media management, is about that relationality. It's about, okay, we're trying to build a community for whatever that reason is. Maybe it's a time-sensitive one, maybe it's we want it to last for years or decades. And I have to kind of make sense of that. I have to keep people convening in a way that makes sense. I have to, like, help build the culture. I have to think about social norms, and I have to keep it safe and healthy and thriving. And then you've got, you know, heads of community, chief community officers. It's a whole thing. So it's kind of an emerging field that's also been around for 40 years, if that makes any sense.
Can I ask, I mean, I'll let Dan get a word in a sec, but I do, you mentioned censorship there, and that is one thing I'm kind of curious about, how that is managed. There were, you know, there have been reports that, for example, in relation to the rollout of vaccines, that there was collaboration with the State Department in the US around minimizing vaccine injuries and stuff like that. Like, you know, that there's content moderation ends up being also you know, something that states have an interest in, which I think is understandable for a variety of reasons. I'm pro-regulation, you know, for obvious reasons. But I do wonder how you balance that with things like censorship or being allowing these communities to become places where certain viewpoints are put somewhat covertly. And I see that as a pretty wicked problem. Like, I don't know that there's an easy answer, but I'm curious to know whether you think there's a growing cohort of principles around that, or that there's a sense of coherence or agreed way in which you tackle it.
That's such an excellent question. And I think, so you're right. And something you pointed out then, which I should have made clear, that's probably the difference, you know, when we think of moderation, content moderation versus, I suppose, social cultural moderation, right? Obviously still involving content, but this is a definition that's internally applied in kind of the moderator, community manager community to distinguish between, okay, my job is to assess a piece of content, often out of context, perhaps for a major platform, or just, you know, in a queue of things. And I'm not thinking about, I know that person's had a bad week, their relationship to that person is X, et cetera. I don't have that deep of view. Whereas community managers, their moderation tends to have the privilege and the affordance of having that deeper context. So they are all navigating this pressure to have a higher degree of regulatory literacy, particularly someone like Australia. What's very interesting is being in this space, being part of a global community of practitioners that do this work, talking with my counterpart, I look after sort of our peak body for these folk here in Australia. I talk a lot with my North American colleagues, my European colleagues. I was in Italy and I connected with the person who runs the Netherlands Community Management Organization and the German Community Management Organization. They're all over the world. And we talk about, you know, different regulatory regimes and how they're impacting our work in different ways. And, you know, so things like the Vola decision around defamation, that had a huge impact, obviously, in the space. And suddenly everyone, including volunteers, was like, oh, my God, we need to think about this now. But for people that were already, certainly those doing it professionally, were already pretty cognizant of it. And so it was a lot of nothing. They were like, well, we've already got the safeguards. We've got risk matrices. We've got policies. We've got protocols. We're doing the work. It's fine. But this pressure exists to start thinking about, as you've all been discussing, you know, a new piece of legislation potentially about doxing, a new piece of legislation about misinformation. Okay, so one of the things that I do is try to help translate what that means for your average community manager in Australia who might be working for a company, say, who's like, all right, so am I now the avatar of that? Am I representing that regulation because I'm the digital frontline worker for my business in this regard? And what does that mean? Do we need to update our guidelines? Do I need to be proactively looking out for this? And it is a wicked problem. So there are definitely best practices, standards, some really good dialogue and, I suppose, documentation and shared assets in the professional space building up around this that are creating a degree of coherence and a great degree of shared approach, but that also allows really critically the shifting for context. So, you know, someone looking after a mental health online community, highly regulated industry, they're already really guard up in terms of their moderation approaches. They're often working with clinicians perhaps as well, for example, versus someone who's working for, you know, a media company. And I talk extensively with all the people doing this work in Australia, and that it is on their minds a lot, right? It's how to thread that needle of how do we balance, kind of this sense of what is the culture of our space? And they also don't want to be the ones to, I suppose, enforce that top down. They know that's not their job. They're like, well, it's co-constituted, right? And the people that are here that we've often invited here to, for whatever reason.
Vanessa, can I interrupt? You just touched on something with regards to the media, which, I witnessed when I was at The Guardian as well. And that was the problem of moderation in regards to scale. So typically, you know, there were many fantastic conversations that happened in the comment thread on The Guardian. And it usually happened when it was a relatively small story or a niche story, and it attracted a bunch of people that were interested in that. And, you know, you get the occasional dickhead, but on the whole, our moderators were able to facilitate a pretty good conversation. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, there was always a few people which were much more active than most, but nonetheless, it added value. The challenge that we often saw, though, was when a story became massive or when that story was posted on Facebook, then and a whole bunch of people came into that community that or came into that story from an environment that wasn't that weren't Guardian readers, if you like, or weren't traditional Guardian readers, but we got fired up about the particular issue. And then the ability for the moderators to kind of keep those social norms, if you like, and keep the, the context the same became virtually impossible. And I sort of, you know, I sort of see this a little bit as well between the platforms. I mean, if you compare Reddit, now I'm not a massive Reddit user, but I go on there from time to time. It's typically the smaller communities, in my experience at least, that seem to have more civil discourse. And once something becomes really large, then it's the trolls take over and it becomes, you know, a shouting fest. Like, this is my impression. I'm not in your role, right? Like, am I on the right track? Is this what you've seen, or is this completely false?
Yeah, can I just double in there with one other Guardian question as well? Because I wanted to ask you, Dan, that your former moderators, they didn't have a personality. They didn't actually do anything but manage the comments. And it was quite a limited version of what a manager could be, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't.
It was more a compliance officer. They were just making sure that.
Yeah, that they were there to facilitate effectively the discourse amongst our readers, right? Rather than actually, they weren't coming in and chiming in with their own perspective, because that was that they weren't being journalists.
Coaching the organised, I don't know. Is there a bit between doing nothing and being another journalist? I guess that's what your guys are, aren't they, Vanessa?
Yeah, I mean, there were also occasions when, you know, we would facilitate an online conversation, with our live blog, and the journalists would have a voice. That's when it's really interesting, in my view, because then it's, you know, then you're about, it's more than a media company broadcast model. It's a conversation with your audience, which I think, you know, as you've touched on, Peter, has huge potential and really, I think, a potential which the media is only just starting to scratch the surface of. I think that we could do that much, much better, or they could do that much, much better. But anyway, I think the problem of scale remains. I think the problem of it becoming a shouting fest, unfortunately, the bigger the conversation, the bigger the problem seems to be the norm.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent observation, and you are, I would say, on the right track with it. and I think, you know, to your point, to tying into what you asked Peter as well, yeah, look, I think this is why I believe that you kind of folks with community manager experience, lived experience and practice, be they and who's they stumbled into it by accident but got an act for it and are really, you know, making an impact, or highly professionalized veterans in the industry, we're on the digital front line. So we're sitting out kind of embedded ethnographically in all of this civic infrastructure. And I just feel like it's often, because it's invisible often or not thought of, it's out of the view. So it's an untapped resource for our institutions, our regulators. I think we're a really interesting voice at the table who can speak to these spaces, what's actually happening, inform and sort of input to a lot of these decisions. The scale thing is really interesting. So there's a lot of great research. I won't bore you with all the details of it, but there's some excellent academic research that, you know, proves that, you know, if we're talking about community, yeah, it breaks when it gets big, right? So, and there are some sort of tipping points, and they're quite small. You know, we're talking hundreds, not thousands, let alone millions or billions. And at that point, you know, it's not a community. So that's why I think it's really important to distinguish between, you know, a platform is not a community. Obviously, a platform can host and give yield many a community. The team at Reddit, who I know very well, both here and globally, you know, talk very clearly about, you know, we are a container for hundreds of thousands of small communities, obviously some bigger than others, but we are not a community. Obviously, platforms also give rise to a certain culture. That's kind of a different thing. But so, yeah, it's the platform piece, right? It's that when you, and so many of these content moderation challenges or moderation challenges are about trying to take sometimes some of the best practices and the logics of this works really well in this community context or with this audience or group over here. Let's just, you know, scale it to a billion people. Of course it's going to collapse, right? And I do think that tool sets, AI, generative AI, some of the interesting stuff on the horizon can and should play a role. That's where, you know, AI is good at scale. Machine learning is good at scale, right?
Because we're almost getting down to the clock, but I did want to ask, do you see your field as being something that will be enhanced or threatened by AI, and what are the questions that need to be asked and got right to make sure it's the latter, not the former?
I think it's, yeah, look, I think it's been contested really interestingly, as are so many other practices right now. I do think there's an immediate assumption, and I hear all the time, especially from technologists who aren't talking to enough moderators or enough sort of culture first folk, who think that, yeah, it's really easy to usurp, like it's going to solve all the problems. Has a big role to play. I've used this analogy a lot. You know, I think it's kind of the Tony Stark Iron Man model of, like, you know, like we build the great set of tools and we put it on and it's the two of us together that have the most superpower. I do think it's kind of like the team player model. I don't think you can eliminate humans from the art of moderation, particularly not at scale.
nor would you AI want to. I mean, that just sounds like a hellscape.
Right, it does, right? It's like,
do we really want the computers moderating the conversation? I mean, that feels right. Dystopian in
I've talked to a few community managers now who are like, yeah, look, they're getting pretty dissuaded in large enterprises where they're like, you know, they want to be, you've got onboarding bots and this bot and that bot and that bot. And they're like, honestly, it feels like it's just, I'm just like moderating a bunch of bots. Like, why am I even here? Is there a human even in the room anymore? So I think that the role to play, Pete, for sure. I do, but I think where the problems come though is when, you know, as always, when this stuff is misapplied, you know, when it does that context flattening, when you go, oh, let's take a commercial algorithm with some sort of logics about surveillance capitalism and try to apply it to a peer support forum where people are sort of helping each other out or looking for things in the wake of a bushfire, or, you know, context where it's just like, it just doesn't apply. What's interesting to me is some of the stuff that's starting to bubble up around more bespoke language models, more kind of, you know, kind of DIY, like, can I configure if I understand my people and my purpose and have a good sense of community management practices, is there like a tech stack or some set of tools where I can design tool sets that are going to actually do these sorts of things, or, you know, using AI tool sets and features in a way that works for my people and my context. And then maybe, I don't know, maybe I have some control and ownership over that. And so I can go, hey, I built this amazing thing, or I helped tool this amazing thing for this, this sort of social enterprise community. Other social enterprise communities, maybe you want a piece of that, right? I think that's really interesting because I think of community managers as context coaches more than
of people. Course, Lizzie's argued that these roles should be elected and paid by the public, haven't you, for community moderators?
I think there's certainly a role for it. Like, the way you're talking, Vanessa, it's sort of these skills that community managers have, like they do sort of seem essential skills for sort of everybody to have or at least know about in the 21st century. It's like a form of digital literacy, like both to understand how spaces are moderated, whether you like it or not, and also articulate what you want the space to look like. It sort of feels like civics for the digital age. And I mean, I do think in that context, we should think about like how we can prioritize, elevate, reward, but also create the right incentives for people doing this work so that it's more transparent and, but also it's done well by the people who are good at it, who are prepared to be accountable. You know, like, I think it's a real role to play in making it more democratic in that sense, as a method of achieving more constructive public spaces on the internet. I don't know if that accords with your vision of why you're involved in this field or what you see it contributes to online life.
I think it really does. I mean, I think I love that you brought it. I invoked civics. I think that's exactly what it is to me. I think I've long said that it's kind of like, I see this stuff as a core 21st century literacy. Yeah, it's really about the principles of digital citizenship to me. It's like, and it would be really some of the more complex things I'm talking about. Okay, but some of the more generalist things I'm talking about, we should kind of all be doing that, knowing about that, you know, should we be teaching in school, right? I think it's a very interesting question. And I was speaking to someone who's appearing at the All Things of Moderation conference the other night, and she's working with what she calls digital stewards in area like war zones and really kind of incredibly violent regions, and sort of help working with them as community managers effectively in these social spaces, some on major platforms, some in more private bespoke communities and and the sort of little digital containers, and trying to get them to do this work. And they're local, they're embedded, and working with them to empower them with these skill sets and finding that they're having a really positive impact out offline and kind of trying to measure those things as well. It's fascinating, right? And so I see examples of what I would call community management. It's the language I've grown up with it being used like this all around the world. I think it's fascinating. I think it's just, yeah, we should be having more conversations about it.
We're probably at the hour. That was a fantastic discussion. Do you just let people, anyone that's listening that wants to register for your conference, you just can give us the short rundown of what it is and when, and we'll put it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. So it's called All Things in Moderation, incredibly unoriginal title. It's on the 16th and 17th of May. I have cool T-shirts. I'll make sure I send you guys some. 16th and 17th of May this year, online, because we want to keep it really equitable. For example, we've got, you know, Kenyan content moderators who were involved in the Sama lawsuit, Lizzie. They're sort of having a roundtable discussion about their work and how they see themselves as soldiers of the internet. It's really interesting. Through to things like workshops in trauma-informed moderation. So there's some really fascinating stuff. We've got regulatory literacy on the agenda. We're looking, talking to media companies, Dan, about lessons that we've learned from moderating the voice referendum in Australia, or maybe haven't learned, things like that. So yeah, so you can go to, yeah, no, it's full on. So easiest way, go to allthingsinmoderation.org. And you'll find all about the conference, link to buy tickets, link to all the sessions that are online. We've also kept it really affordable and cheap for everyone because, you know, we need to.
I'll be there.
We want everyone to be there. And everything's on demand too. So, you know, we're busy. If you can't make stuff live, Come along, watch on the rewind.
Yeah, like I say, I'll be there with bells on. Hey, we better wind it up. Thanks. That's a fantastic discussion. Look after yourselves, Dan, Lizzie, Vanessa. Sure, we'll have you back again too, Vanessa. That was a great discussion.
Thanks, guys.
Let's just talk again in a fortnight. Cheers.
Thanks, folks.
That was Burning Platforms, brought to you by Per Capita's Centre of the Public Square. It was recorded on April 9 and produced on Narm Land by Rebecca Connell. Talk again soon.